This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. Anyone can become an agent of innovation. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, we're coming up on our one-year anniversary.
It's crazy.
We've been doing this
by.
For a year.
Yeah, I know.
How are we going to celebrate? A little date night? 80s
maybe,
movie?
Yeah, 80s movie, some dinner, maybe, I don't know. Who knows where it might go?
Okay, whoa, that got weird. Before we celebrate that, though, I feel like we've talked about a lot of corners of the ETF world, except for one.
Yeah, we are squeezing in the one thing we haven't talked about just in the nick of time for this whole year.
Before date night.
Yeah, and then we will have, I think, officially covered everything at least once, and this is market making.
What is that?
So market making, you know, I equate market making to sort of the oil that keeps the whole machine running, or to bring it to a much more broader reference, is McDonald's. Market makers are basically providing Happy Meals all day long. They are just churning out customers. In fact, if you look at the total amount of ETF trading over 25 years since they came out, it's about $200 trillion worth of trades. The average trade size is about $20,000. That means there's been 10 billion ETF trades. And that 10 billion trades is countered with maybe 30, 40,000 sort of issues where there was a problem with a trade. So you compare those two numbers, that's why I think these market makers and how they give everyone a happy meal, everybody's happy, is why I think ETFs are largely immune from the attacks, the criticism, and the worries, is because the customers come in, get their happy meal, they're like, that was fine with me.
But the happy meal actually was all about the toy. Is there a toy in this metaphor?
Well, I don't know. My son loves the nuggets.
The nuggets?
Yeah,
right.
He likes. And now they have
take
healthy.
The toy.
Yeah, and my wife makes him get the apples, yeah. And she does not eat.
Yeah, not so happy. Joining us on this episode, Annie Massa, who's a reporter with the Bloomberg News Investing Team. She just wrote a story called Raising the Stakes in the latest issue of Bloomberg Markets. That's about one of the most famous market makers, which we'll get into. And also Chris Hempstead, who's the head of ETF sales at Deutsche Bank. This week on Trillions, let's make a market. Annie, Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Annie,
thanks.
Raising the Stakes, what's this story about?
The story is about a firm called Susquehanna, and it's been around in the ETF market-making ecosystem for a really long time. And
How long?
Well, the firm was founded in 1987, so that was before you even had ETFs in the U.S., and they were founded as an options trading firm, and they're still huge in options. But very early on in the timeline of ETFs, they got into ETF trading before it was even a thing.
A thing.
Yeah, exactly, before it was cool. And they've really survived as an independent, proprietary market maker.
Closely held.
Closely held, yep.
Highly secretive.
And very secretive, yeah. for all these years. And they've really become one of the biggest market makers of ETFs in the U.S. and in the world.
And let me just jump in here. Susquehanna, a lot of people may not have ever even heard of them.
Yeah.
And Jane Street is another one. You add it up, and a good chunk of all the ETF market making, which is, you know, matching buyers and sellers and whatnot, happens through companies that are not large investment banks. Some investment banks do it, but I think that's interesting. How did you look into that?
Yeah, I wanted to address that in the story because investment banks, especially since the 2008 crisis, have kind of stepped back from playing some of these key roles in the ETF ecosystem. And since then, there's been even more runway for these smaller prop firms to get involved. And they've stepped in to fill the void in some ways.
And when you say prop, what does that mean?
They're trading with their own capital.
Right, which is something that banks used to be able to do and can no longer. And that's one of the reasons that they've filled this void so well.
Exactly.
So there's a certain game that people who work in market making are very good at. And you learned a little bit more about that. What's the game?
Yes, it is poker. And especially at Susquehanna, this has always been true. They love Texas Hold'em. They have an annual No Limit Texas Hold'em championship basically every year. Their traders are trained in poker. And the idea is that they wanted, first of all, the founders all like met in college at SUNY Binghamton and they all like to play cards together. But they quickly found out that they could apply some of the same skills to financial markets.
This almost sounds like a dream where we're like going to go to college, play poker all the time and then say like, okay, how do we take our poker skills and get a job?
I know. And found a firm that will go on to be very successful, you know?
And make millions and millions of dollars.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. And so they've kept this program of training their traders with poker and other kinds of games too. They even have like they have a gaming blog like on strategy for everything from like Scrabble to, you know, any kind of game that you could imagine. So they love gaming there, but especially poker.
Why is poker a significant game and how does it relate to ETFs?
So the idea is they see poker as a great game that allows you to kind of practice making decisions in uncertain circumstances, probability-based decisions in uncertain circumstances. And that mindset applies to financial markets too. Because, you know, obviously you don't have control over all the other whims of the market, but you can make these like probability-based decisions in those kinds of uncertain circumstances.
And Susquehanna particularly is the sort of original firm, and it's kind of been like a farm team, a farm league for superstars that have gone off and gone to other firms in the market making business, right? It's sort of like BlackRock is like that on the issuer side. You go to a lot of ETF firms, issuers, a lot of them are like, yeah, I used to work at BlackRock. And Susquehanna is kind of like that for the market making side. Is that right?
Yeah, the way I was thinking about it is it's almost like a diaspora of people who just have spread out from Susquehanna as their home base. And by the way, people stay there for a long time too, typically. And they really cut their teeth there. And then the people who have left have risen to the top at other notable market making firms. And one of the ones that I mentioned in the story is Jane Street, which is now a very fierce rival of Susquehanna's, was founded by three ex-Susquehanna guys.
And another ex-Susquehanna guy sitting right here.
Yep.
My opening question for you, Chris, is how good at poker are you?
I am not necessarily a good poker player.
How did you get through the system?
But I would sit in that tournament every year. You know, every employee plays at least one hand, and I would certainly try to compete with the brightest of the firm and last as long as I could. But easier said than done.
So you started at Susquehanna?
Right. So I'm myself and others like me when we came into Susquehanna were brought into the firm because they started to trade more ETFs, which were different than their core business prior to that, which was options trading. ETFs trade more like a stock, but they're derivative in nature. And so operators like myself in the equity world would come up and apply some of our equity trading background to this derivatively backed equity-like product on the American Stock Exchange. And we were originally, like kind of hired guns in a sense to operate the display book, which not many people know what that is, but it's back when the trading was done on the floor of the stock exchange.
And so this is like mid-90s?
This is mid and late 90s, yeah. Is when that sort of started to really pick up, especially in the late 90s with the listing of the QQQ on the American Stock Exchange in March of 99.
Right.
And after that, it was pretty much hockey stick growth and activity. And we were very lucky, I think. A lot of the folks in the role that I was in, a lot of my peers at Susquehanna and other firms like Spearleads and Kellogg, which was later acquired by Goldman Sachs, and there's several firms from the American Stock Exchange era that did these kind of ETF and option trading market making operations. They all needed operators, and our job was very unique and very different. And most of us survived the post stock market, you know, the post stock exchange trading world, and were able to take what we learned from working with really bright people at SIG and Spearleads and other places and apply that in other places because the ETF industry was growing so fast, you know, as the market structure changed, there was a significant need for people who understood the product and understood the math behind it. And if you could go somewhere and apply that, there was a job for you.
So Eric says making markets is like serving Happy Meals. How would you describe it?
Well, it depends on where we're cooking, I guess, or where we're serving. So, you know, we always make it a point to differentiate between the most widely held and most widely trafficked in products. So you think SPY, EEM, IWM, there's the GLD. These are the most active by notional volume, the most active by trading volume in many cases, and the most widely held across the investment universe. Those products, the term market making is not as applicable to those. It's not something that a traditional market maker would need to step in and say, oh, in the absence of buyers, I can be a seller. In the absence of sellers, I can be a buyer, or something along those lines. Let me flip that. In the absence of sellers, I can sell, and in the absence of buyers, I can buy. That's traditionally what a market maker does. A market maker injects liquidity into the market when it's needed and sits on the sideline when it's not needed. When it's not needed is when buyers and sellers meet naturally in the market. The thing about ETFs that's unique is that there's 2,230-something ETFs today in the U.S.
I think about 2,200,
yeah,
exactly.
So
yes.
It's something right around there. And that super liquid, widely held, or high volume and widely trafficked in ETF list is really only like 100, sometimes 200 names on any given day. That means there's the better part of 2,000 products that don't trade buyer to seller naturally in the market in most cases. And the further down that list you go, the more likely it is that any transaction in the market, a buy or a sell, is most likely, more likely than not, going to transact with a market maker. Because the odds of the four of us sitting at this table as retail investors trading with one another in ETF rank number 1,000, whatever product that is, mm-hmm. is so low that the quote you see on the screen on whatever exchange or on all the exchanges is probably being provided by a market maker in anticipation of potentially someone buying or selling that product.
So let's just try to visualize this. On any given day, people are putting in orders for SPY or IVV or HYG, and that order is being matched electronically on the exchange for the most part. And market makers are not needed for those transactions. You can put in a market order, right? Just give me this ETF at the best available price for the top 100. Then below that is when, you know, the spreads are a little wider, meaning the price that someone would buy it for versus sell it, right? And that's when a market maker might step in and make a market in those products?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that the spread widens out, although you can definitely make the argument that the less active a name is and the less that people are using it, that it would seem to indicate it would be a wider spread, but not always the case. I think it's the increased likelihood that you're not going to be transacting with somebody natural, with somebody who happens to be selling when you're buying or buying when you're
selling.
You guys
call those naturals, right?
Yes, we do.
That's when the buyer-seller matches and you're not involved, and that's just a natural.
No need for us. In the real estate market, imagine if you're in a grocery store and the buyer of a house and the seller of a house just meet and the broker's standing there saying, what the heck? What just happened?
Well, I guess we get 3% still. No, you may not.
What percent of the daily trading volume in ETFs, which is about, let's say, $50 billion or something?
I think it's been north of that. October, we were seeing north of $100 billion a day.
Yeah, that was volatile times. They definitely, but on average, let's say 50, 60 a day. Mm-hmm. Right? What percentage of that is naturals versus market makers?
I mean, it's probably going to be north of 80% naturals. In other words, and by the way, that does not mean that that's going to include some high frequency traders, right? Because they're not really market making. They're just, you know, they're trading. They have strategies and algorithms. Other hedge funds and institutions might use these products as hedges. They're naturals. Even though it might not be part of their investment philosophy, they're using the product in a natural way. For what we're talking about today, market making is more in the traditional sense. Hey, can I come to you and ask you for a bid or an offer at any time of the day? And you'll make one for me. That's the more traditional sense. And yeah, I would guess it's way under 20% of the volume on any given day is that. Now there's something that's changed also in the last couple of years, and there's new technologies that these trading firms that we all our orders eventually at Schwab or TD or wherever might wind up on a trading desk somewhere if it meets some metric. And that's going to go out into what we call RFQ. You know, Bloomberg has an RFQE technology.
Although that's request for quote.
Yeah.
Right? And that's just where you go out there, request for quote, and it goes out and finds it surveys all the market makers that get the best price, right?
That's right.
And that's
well, the ones that are enabled, right? Is it, so right. It's the you know, look, I mean, there's probably a little less than 10 market making firms that are in most of the RFQ wheels, so it's not a wildly competitive market in terms of the numbers, but it is incredibly competitive in terms of the margins. The pricing today in ETFs has never been better in terms of the efficient, you know, pricing that people are getting in the secondary market. But when they go out and do this, that's so if someone was to transact in a block of an ETF that trades once a week, that's probably going to be a market maker providing liquidity. Those volumes, because they're blocks, can be a little bit higher, and that might be where most of that market maker activity in terms of notional volume exists. When I talk about that, you know, what doesn't go natural is probably in block liquidity.
This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. What do all the greatest innovations have in common? Agents, people who participate in progress by supporting cutting edge ideas. Invesco QQQ is a fund that allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100 all in one fund. So you don't have to be an inventor to help create what's next to come. Anyone can become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETF risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 Index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit Invesco.com for a prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully before investing. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Margins, though, being as thin as they are, brings it back to poker a little bit, because the strategy at Susquehanna, at least it seems, is rather than trying to get these big one-time payouts, it's just like eke out the pennies, and then that pile of pennies happens to actually be worth a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to answer, you know, for what SIG does, you know, for their strategies, but I can tell you that what's great about ETFs and what the world needs to continually be reminded of is these are transparent wrappers. These are transparent vehicles. They, on a daily basis, provide us with what their holdings file is, what's in their holdings file, and also what's needed for creation and redemption. So most of the time, the products, the kind of products that are within an ETF, whether it's futures, whether it's swap, whether it's equities or bonds, there's price discovery mechanisms for market makers to go and figure out what the ingredients are worth. So Eric talks about making a Happy Meal. Well, imagine if McDonald's had 2,000 different kinds of Happy Meals. But I work in the kitchen, and I have all the ingredients that I need. And so when you order Happy Meal number 1732, I simply pull up the recipe, the holdings file, and I look and I say, well, how much is it going to cost me to buy these ingredients and put it in the Happy Meal box and deliver it back to you? So if I look and it's all preloaded every night. We have really sharp people that download that stuff, and I put it up 1700 and whatever, and it says, okay, I'm going to need these 30 different ingredients, and it's going to cost me $25 to make this Happy Meal. Well, that's my break-even price. Right, so I'm probably going to offer you the Happy Meal at $25 and a penny, right? And this is just for example purposes only. But that's the mentality behind market making
ETFs. That's an expensive Happy Meal.
Yeah, pricey Happy Meal. Better be a good toy.
That toy better be illegal.
That one had caviar and saffron. So you know.
I just want to stop here for a second, because what you're tapping into is something we've built a lot in the terminal, which is implied liquidity, mm-hmm. which is when you talk about the top 15 most traded ETFs account for half of all volume. Then the other 2,150 or whatever are fighting over the rest. And a lot of them get ignored because people are used to stocks where the volume on the screen is all there is. But with an ETF, you can punch up the recipe. In other words, you can use the volume of the underlying stocks. So for example, if we pull up something like the PowerShares S&P High Quality ETF, which isn't one of the more popular quality factor ETFs. I think it might trade 40,000 shares a day.
Right.
But the implied liquidity says 51 million shares could be created on the spot because that recipe is liquid. Is that essentially the key to unlocking the toolbox and using some of these lesser traded products that might be a better fit because people do tend to lean on these ones that came out in the 90s that trade a lot.
Yeah, I mean, just remember, if you're a user of ETFs, you don't have to worry so much about having the toolbox or the key. It's more important for you to trust that your broker and the person you're working with for these executions in the Invesco, high quality index, that they have the key in the toolbox. And basically what we're going to be looking at is maybe we're not going to do a 40 million share trade. We'd love to do that, right? But if someone comes in and says, hey, there's 40,000 shares that trade on a daily basis and we want to buy 1 million shares, what we're looking at as a market maker, as a liquidity provider, is we're looking at, can I access the ingredients of that fund without moving the market? Am I going to be able to reasonably obtain all the ingredients that I need at a reasonable or at least a some sort of a confident price level? Anything outside of that, we would call, in the old world, we'd call that slippage. I thought I could buy it for 25, and when I went to actually buy all the ingredients, the price moved. I actually impacted the market, and it came out to 25.05. And I would say to my boss, look, I thought I could buy the ingredients for 25. It wound up costing me 25.05. And he'd say, well, where'd you sell the Happy Meal? And I'd say 25.01. Well, guess what? I lost, right? That's where the betting and gambling kind of mentality would be associated with market making. So market makers generally don't make that mistake, okay? They're actually doing, pre-trade analytics, and they have a very good high confidence in how much they can buy at what price level, how much they think they're going to move the market given a certain size. We love to talk about implied liquidity. We love to talk about, if I was to do 1 million shares of this ETF, it could be 10,000% of a day's volume of the ETF itself, but it can be 0.1% of the underlying portfolio. And that's what we want people to remember. If you're a broker and your trading partner has the tools and the toolbox to view that as 0.1% of the underlying liquidity, well, then you should expect pricing that's reflective of that.
What does it take to be good at that? Because it strikes me that there are very few ETF market making firms that are actually really good. Like, one thing that I heard when I was reporting on that story is, the volume of ETF trading and the number of ETFs has just gone up and up and up. And the number of really strong ETF market makers has stayed small. So what does it take to be like a good ETF market maker?
Look, I mean, when you talk about the SPYs and the IWMs and the QQQs, it's a different trading strategy. It's a different sort of mentality. Again, you're not expecting to be able to sell QQQ and then buy the underlying NASDAQ 100 names at a material discount to where you sold the ETF. That just doesn't happen. It's so efficient, those products. But the competitive field that we're talking about is, what does it take to be competitive in that Invesco product? What does it take for someone to be able to compete with five other market makers and provide the best price at ridiculously low margins? So, you're talking about fractions of a penny in many cases, depending on the size of the trade. It takes a lot. Technology is a big part of it. And data within that technology is also a big part of it. So you've got to have access to the information of the ETFs. And there's 2,270 ETFs. So it's a lot of information that you're pulling in every night. You've got to be able to apply market data to all of the underlying instruments. And there's, gosh knows how many different equities in the ETF universe, over 5,000, and how many different bonds, probably well over 10,000. I mean, there's so much data, and it has to be constantly updated, and it has to be constantly monitored and maintained. And when you get it all right in a perfect world, right, and you've got all the data and you've got all the recipes and your computers are humming and everyone's happy and everything looks great, all the lights are green, it's pretty easy, actually. You look it up and someone pulls up a ticker and they say, can I get a price on it? You pull it up and you've got your highly confident pricing that you can provide to your clients, and they love your pricing and they trade with you. But what happens when one of the data feeds goes down? What happens when there's a corporate action that didn't get picked up by the issuer but did get picked up by the distributor, and there's a difference in information? Because with, I don't know how many, 100 unique issuers and gosh knows how many different custodial banks and distributors, we're getting information from a lot of different unique sources every single day. Normalizing it is a massive task, right? And so it requires investment. It requires confidence. It requires really, really smart people, who know how to code, so that at any given time, when the light goes from green to red and says, look here, something's amiss, you can get to that very quickly, adjust your formula, adjust whatever input is questionable, and get back to business.
Is there really a light that goes from green to red?
Okay. I can neither confirm nor deny the existence of a red light, green light, yellow light.
I want to ask about SPHQ. That's that high quality, mm-hmm. doesn't trade a lot. Say an order comes in for this. I found this kind of fascinating when I learned it. When it's not a natural and somebody wants SPHQ, you cannot find a natural buy order to sell order to buy it, right?
That's right.
So you got to look at the recipe. You give them the SPHQ immediately for a certain price. Mm-hmm. Then what happens, right? You don't actually have SPHQ yet. You have to go take the raw materials, the recipe, hand it into PowerShares or the AP, and then get SPHQ to make yourself even. Walk us through that,
sure.
that process and how long it takes.
So it's important for everyone to realize that your trading counterparties in these ETFs, especially SPHQ, are most likely licensed to create or manufacture shares when they're needed. And issuers don't like to hear this, but they're also licensed to destroy or redeem shares when there's too much supply. The ability to create...
This is the magic of the ETF
arbitrage, the ETF ecosystem. It's called being an authorized participant. Whether you're directly an authorized participant or indirectly through your clearing bank is what's important. But if you have the ability to manufacture or destroy, create or redeem ETF shares, when you come in and buy SPHQ from us and we don't have shares and there's no borrow. But by the way, most of the 2,200 and change ETFs, there is no borrow on them, right? So most of the time, if you're buying these and in a material way, a market maker is going to probably have to create shares to settle that trade. So in SPHQ, you come in, you buy 1 million shares, and I'm going to turn around, buy the ingredients of the fund. Now I'm going to take those ingredients, deliver them to PowerShares. PowerShares is going to say, thank you very much. In return for those securities, which they're going to put into the ETF trust, which is their own unique ETF trust protected, and they're going to give me back 1 million ETF shares of SPHQ, which I'm going to deliver right back to the client. So the round trip is, what are the ingredients? I go out and get them. I put them into the Happy Meal. You give the Happy Meal to the client.
And this is happening in fractions of a second.
I mean, the process of doing the trade with the client and buying the underlying portfolio, yes, it could be a fraction of a second. There may be times where we choose to go out and buy the ingredients of an ETF over a longer period of time. When you look at the high-yield bond market or investment-grade bonds or maybe some frontier markets, it might take longer to go out and buy the actual underlying securities. You might want to be a little more thoughtful in how you go about getting it. But essentially, yes, you trade the ETF and then you get the ingredients and then you do the creation.
The back office kicks in.
So because market making is so secretive, it leads me to believe that it's highly lucrative as well. How lucrative actually is it?
I don't think it's secretive. I don't. Anyone can go to an issuer's website. The great thing also about the U.S. ETF marketplace is that to be listed on an exchange in the United States for an ETF, you need to have a website. You need to have information available for people to go and look. If your website's not available, you're not in compliance. On the websites, you'll find the holdings file. So anyone can look at the holdings file, figure out what's in it, figure out what the weights are, or not even figure it out, just download the data and then figure out what it costs to assemble that portfolio and in turn, what's a fair price for this ETF. That is the secret sauce. That's not so secret, right?
It never is.
The competitive edge is
it's actually mayonnaise and ketchup.
But here's the convenience factor. Because you can basically copy an ETF every day and not have to pay the issuer the expense ratio or do the trade.
Then you have to manage it too, though.
Right.
Then, and look, there's I always like to sit down with clients, sit down with users, explain how it works, show them how to do it. They get that moment of clarity. They get that moment, that eureka moment, like, I get it. And then they also at the same time realize, that's a lot of work. I don't want to do that. Yeah. And what they really want to do is, do you have a system that does that a lot faster and a lot more efficiently? And the 10 market making firms you allude to, where the ETF industry has grown and the market making community has just gotten faster, not necessarily bigger, that's ultimately the answer. So while the sauce is not so secret, the way that people cook things is a little bit proprietary, right?
Hasn't it evolved though, like where you have some market maker, like if you're just making markets and ETFs on exchanges, like you don't really have to tell anybody anything about what you're doing or how you're doing it. But if you have clients who are coming directly to you and trying to do ETF trades, like then you kind of have to open yourself up a little bit more, right?
I mean, we me personally, I've sort of migrated from the trading world into more of an educational, client-facing world. I love when they ask questions about how and why we price things the way we do. I love to tell them what we're thinking. I love to tell them how much we think we're going to need to make or how much we're going to have to price things to make it worth our while to do the trade or to get into business. Unfortunately, not a lot of people ask those questions all the time. There are people who come in and just trust you know how to do it, and you get the order, and they move on. If you're always giving them good, fair pricing, and you continue to get that business, they may not ask every time how you came up with the price. But I do enjoy when people engage because it gives me hope that because they're asking questions, they're probably looking at other products. A lot of people will only look at those top 50, those top 100 products because they're easy to trade. But they don't really add a whole lot of value in terms of an investment mandate, right? And so when they come up with SPHQ and they come in and they say, hey, can you tell me about this product? I want to get on the phone. I want to spend an hour with them. I say, this is what's cool about this product. This is why PowerShares loves it. This is why we can make a market in it and others can probably too. This is what we would consider a fair level. You know, for this, you know, transacting within these bands, you can never lose to asking questions and learning more, I think. It gives you the confidence to take that next step and buy that product you'd never heard of. And guess what? You know, you're going to be the cool kid on the block who owns the product no one else does.
And based on lucrative, I will address that a little bit. We've looked into the revenue of the ETF world. We track it. Issuers make about $7 billion a year. That is not much. I mean, that's on the issuer side. Active mutual funds make, you know, four or five times that amount on the same amount of assets. Market makers make about half of the $7 billion. We've calculated about $3.5 billion. And that's on an average spread of 0.015%. So we're talking razor-thin margins. It's actually not that lucrative. Most of the ETF industry has to really live frugally and be scrappy. It's not like the old Wall Street. I find that's why it's so popular, because everybody comes in and feels like they got a good deal.
Okay, so I have one more question. What's your favorite ticker?
What's my favorite ticker? Oh, my goodness. Oh, man. Well, I got to say, I mean, 2018, there's an ETF called RVRS, Reverse. And I just think it's a really neat thing.
What's in that?
There's S&P 500 market cap, SPY. And then there's RSP, which I loved for a long, long time. I love equal weight. S&P 500, I personally, from my account, I'm like, I like equal weight better than market cap weight. And then these folks invented RVRS, and it's reverse cap weight. And if you think of it as a triangle, I'm drawing a triangle on a podcast.
Apple is the lowest weighting.
I like the idea. A ticker serves it well. RVRS, reverse.
That's a great one.
Yeah, I think they use the Uno card, the reverse Uno card, to market the product. It was pretty good.
It's neat.
Although they have beer glasses, but I told them that the top should be small and it should widen out.
You're going to get me in a ton of trouble with that question because, like, that was on the spot. I didn't know it was coming. And I'm sure they're going to be psyched that I did it. But, you know, I'll get one really great phone call from that. And I'll be like, thanks so much for saying that. And I'm going to get 100. Yeah. Like, why didn't you mention mine? There's so many good tickets.
Eric, I want to say I didn't forget about you. Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary, Joel.
Chris, Annie, thanks for joining us on Trillions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to us on Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and basically anywhere else you want to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. Annie's at Antonia B. Massa. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.